Acts chapter 20 is a fascinating passage because it presents to us one of the interesting anecdotes of the life of the early church. In particular, the first number of verses in Acts chapter 20 are significant because they give us an insight into what we would refer to as a worship service. It's undeniable, if you look early in the book of Acts, that the worship habits of the early church tended to be more daily, more organic. I mean, the church just kind of lived together. You know what I mean? If you went in Acts 2, for instance, in the amazing passage in Acts 2, beginning somewhere around verse 36, where it talks about that they had all things in common and they were daily meeting together, devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching, to the breaking of bread, and to the prayers. That doesn't sound like it was scheduled. And this is something we should keep in mind, that the church at its best is not scheduled. It is simply a life arising together out of our shared experience, together. I mean, it's when we weep together or laugh together or work together or come together to resolve things or whatever. I mean, it's the daily working out of being the church in which the church happens. Now, all that's to say that while that is ideal, the scheduled events of the church have their place. But we never want to reduce the life of the church to the church calendar, right? The church is more than the scheduled events of the church. The church is life lived together. But what is interesting about Acts 20 is that this is one of the few instances where we seem to get a glimpse into what an early Sunday worship service would have looked like for the church. So that's what we're going to focus on tonight. And this is just one of those times where it's fortuitous that we deal with the early church coming together, hearing the word, and taking the Lord's Supper on the night when we've come together to hear the word and take the Lord's Supper. And I just think that is an awesome, awesome thing. So Acts chapter 20, beginning verses 1 through 16. Let's look first of all at the first six verses, which are basically just kind of a travel log of Paul's movements. After the uproar ceased, what uproar? Were you here this morning? I mean, that's the uproar. After all of that was over, Paul sent for the disciples, and after encouraging them, he said farewell and departed for Macedonia. When he had gone through those regions and had given them much encouragement, he came to Greece. There he spent 3 months, and when a plot was made against him by the Jews, as he was about to set sail for Syria, he decided to return through Macedonia. Reading this is kind of frustrating for me because my mother last week won a $5,000 cruise to Greece and all of these areas. And so she and my father are going, and I'm telling her, look, you can hang around Dad anytime. You know, your son in Arkansas is the one you never, never get to see. So all of these things. And then she called and said they upgraded it and added Barcelona and all these things. I'm like, what's happening? This isn't right. Well, Paul is moving throughout, and as he goes, he's encouraging and he's strengthening the churches. He decides to return through Macedonia. Sopater, the Berean, son of Pyrrhus, accompanied him. Here's just a list of his team. Accompanied him, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus and Secundus, and Gaius of Derbe and Timothy, and the Asians, Tychicus and Trophimus. These went on ahead and were waiting for us at Troas, but we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and in 5 days we came to them at Troas, where we stayed for 7 days. Just a little brief comment on after the days of unleavened bread. Again, as I mentioned this morning, it is interesting that the early church still kind of moved along the contours of the Jewish calendar. I think this simply needs to be understood for historical accuracy. I do not think the first Jewish Christians in the early church would have repudiated every single aspect of their Jewishness. Clearly not. Paul took a Nazarite vow. They tended to try to meet in the temple. They tried to meet in some of the synagogues. It's hard for us as North American Protestant Christians, Gentiles, to appreciate the fact that those who came out of Judaism still appreciated certain aspects of it. It's just that they understood now that Christ fulfilled these aspects. I think about my grandfather, who was raised as a Roman Catholic. His mother, my great-grandmother, Bridget Curran, was an Irish Catholic, like from the boat, off the boat from Ireland, and led my great-grandfather into Catholicism. So my granddaddy was raised Catholic, became a Baptist preacher, but for most of his life went to midnight mass on Christmas Eve by himself. And what's interesting about that is my oldest brother is now pastoring in my hometown a church that my grandfather pastored 30 years ago. And last time I was home, I went in that sanctuary and looked immediately. I could remember sitting, swinging my legs off of the little pew, sitting next to my grandmother, and could see it. But my father and mother have now joined that church. And my dad told me a couple of weeks ago that one of the elderly ladies came up who remembered my grandfather and said, "Something has always bothered me. Why did your father continue to go to midnight mass if he was our preacher?" And probably because it was nostalgic, probably because both of his parents died when he was a boy and he was raised by his sister, and probably because he appreciated some of the aesthetic elements of it. You know, in other words, you can appreciate certain aspects of what you came out of without having to repudiate everything. And that's probably what happened. So I would say be careful in judgment of those who may have come out of traditions that it's easy for you to just dismiss completely, that they may have had, you know, some appreciation, some comfort for parts of it. And I think that's how we should view the early church and their Jewishness. I mean, these guys were Jews. And they appreciated certain parts of this. And they kept up with, for instance, the days of unleavened bread. Now, verse 7 is where our focus is going to come tonight. And in pretty quick fashion, I just want us to look closely at verse 7 and the verses that follow and realize that we're getting a glimpse into a worship service from the first century. So four things quickly about the early church. The first of the four is this. The early church met on Sundays. Look at verse 7. On the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul talked with them. This is the church at Troas, and they meet on the first day of the week. I simply say this to point out that while it seems as if for some time the early church tried to maintain kind of Saturday worship to an extent, the resurrection of Christ reprogram their sense of when they should meet for corporate worship. Why do we meet on Sundays instead of Saturdays? Because of the resurrection. Do you realize we talk about Easter Sunday? That attendance report, if you go back and look at it, I think the highest Sunday from last year was 700 and something people Easter Sunday morning. In every church in this community, the highest attendance day would have been Easter Sunday morning. That's awesome, but let me point out, every Sunday is Easter for the Christian church. We don't meet every Friday because of the cross. We love the cross. It's the fact that he came back, that he's alive. So first of all, the early church met on Sundays. Now there's some question in the language about whether or not this is Saturday night leading into Sunday or Sunday night leading into Monday, and that's because the Jews and the Roman, and this is in the Roman Empire, the Jews and the Romans figured days differently. The Romans figured a day as being from midnight to midnight. That's what we do. That's the way we approach it. The Jews figured it from sundown to sundown. And so if you kind of look at that closely, it's hard to say. Probably this is a reference to the service starting on the day of Sunday, leading up to midnight and deep into the night, on into Monday morning when Paul leaves Monday morning. So, they gather on Sunday. Secondly, this, the early church put an emphasis on the Lord's Supper. Watch verse 7 and then verse 11. On the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul talked with them. Verse 11, and when Paul had gone up and had broken bread and eaten, he conversed with them. Okay, here's the deal. In the New Testament, sometimes it's a little tricky to figure out if the references to breaking bread are simply references to them, you know, eating together, right? Just having a meal. Or if it is a Lord's Supper reference. Sometimes there are linguistic clues like the definite article, the breaking of bread or something like that. That seems to be more formal. So the breaking of bread would probably be a reference. It is almost universally agreed that breaking of bread here is a reference to the Lord's Supper. So I'm going to propose a very un-Baptist idea to you and then let you go home and talk about me behind my back. Okay? I think if you read the New Testament honestly and look at the references to the Lord's Supper, I think it is almost a certainty that the early church took the Lord's Supper every time they gathered. I just do. I don't think it is taught that you must do that. So now some of you can exhale. I think it is prescriptive. I think it is descriptive, not prescriptive. But it seems to be, and this is definite, I'm trying to couch this in careful language. It's not clear, but it seems to be that when they gathered, they celebrated the Lord's Supper. Now, it also seems to be the case, especially if you look at 1 Corinthians, that every time they gathered, they had a meal. Amen? Because if you look at what Paul says to the church of Corinth in 1 Corinthians, I didn't look it up, I think it's chapter 11, when he says, I hear a report that many of you are coming together at your love feast, you know, and some of you are getting drunk and some of you are having these great parties while other people have nothing. That shouldn't be. Meaning it had kind of become like a party almost. Probably what happened in the early church was this. They would gather together, oftentimes in the evening. Can I point out something that we forget? It's so hard for me to remember this in reading the New Testament. They didn't have Sundays off. This was the Roman Empire. A Sunday there was like a Monday to us. These people had to work during the day. That's why they met at night. Right? They're meeting here at night. So this would be a real tricky one for a good number of our church who won't come on Sunday evening. The early church met on Sunday night out of necessity. We grew up in a Christian world. They grew up in a pagan world. They didn't get Sundays off. These people were probably working if they were forced to. Anyway, they come together and they break bread. Probably every week. You say, well, there's no Baptist precedence. That's absolutely true, except for Charles Spurgeon, probably the most well-known, famous, most effective Baptist preacher in our entire history, who celebrated the Lord's Supper in a church of 10,000 people every Sunday. By the way, if you look at Baptist history, British Baptists have been more comfortable with more consistent Lord's Supper practices than American Baptists. We picked up the idea of quarterly, and then we took it downhill from there. There are Baptist churches having the Lord's Supper once a year, and the Bible does not say specifically how much, not clearly does it teach us how much, but let me say, what happens on that table is important enough for us to make it a priority. This church does it once a month. I'm at peace for that, just because I know how far I can push y'all before you revolt. If I had my way, we'd do it every week, and this, that, and the other, then y'all could say, it will lose its meaning. That's what Baptists say. If we do it every week, it'll lose its meaning. But you never hear a Baptist say that about taking up the offering. I'm just saying. I've never heard that about singing hymns. If we sing hymns every week, it'll lose its meaning. If we take the offering every week, it'll lose its meaning. If we have sermons, but the Lord's Supper, we can't do that. I'm just saying, don't worry, relax. It's not a proposal. They put a priority on it. Why? Because it reminded them in a hostile environment of their life together. They needed the symbols of the bread, and they needed the symbol of the blood. They needed to remember. Thirdly, the early church put an emphasis on apostolic teaching. Look at verse 7. On the first day of the week when we were gathered together, this is where it gets a little funny. On the first day of the week when we were gathered together to break bread, Well, first day of the week, gathered together, broke bread. Paul talked with them, intending to depart on the next day, and he prolonged his speech until midnight. Those of you who complain about sermon length really need to listen to what's about to go down in Acts chapter 20. Y'all okay? Some of y'all look upset. That Lord's Supper stuff unnerve you? Just relax. Look, I got to be able to vent these things aloud among my friends in the church. It's okay, all right? Just because all of you are wrong about it doesn't mean you have to be upset. Intending to depart on the next day, he prolonged his speech until midnight. There were many lamps in the upper room where we were gathered. So they are gathered together. They're in an upper room. And Paul has, quote, now notice how many times in Luke's record he mentions how long Paul talks. There's one. He prolonged his speech. And there were many lamps in the upper room where we were gathered, and a young man named Eutychus, sitting at the window, sank into a deep sleep as Paul talked still longer. And being overcome by sleep, he fell down from the third story and was taken up dead. Now, some people are skeptical and say that he didn't actually die, that the language suggests that he actually died. In other words, people say, no, he got the breath knocked out of him and it wasn't really a miracle. I mean, everyone thought he was dead, he wasn't. The language actually seems to suggest that he actually died, that this is a miracle that happens. So he falls out of the third story window and is taken up dead. But Paul went down and bent over him and said, that was very rude because I wasn't done preaching yet. No, just kidding. But Paul went down and bent over him, and taking him in his arms said, do not be alarmed, for his life is in him. And when Paul, watch this. And when Paul had gone up and had broken bread and eaten, he conversed with them a long while until daybreak, and so he departed. Time after time after time, Luke depicts Paul as teaching and talking with the church. If you look at Acts 20, particularly verse 7 and onwards, and say, what would an early church service have looked like? They would have gathered on Sunday. They probably had a meal every time, and they probably had the Lord's Supper. And then they would surround apostolic teaching and listen closely. I almost put an extra point on this. They didn't watch the clock. Now, maybe they should have, for Eutychus's sake. Or, you know, I'm being serious here. Maybe they were a family, and if you got tired, you could go into the back of the room and lay down. I'm cool with that. But the point is, this mattered to them. You know, when you hear missionaries to China talk about meeting in the underground house churches of China, small rooms with a bare light bulb and 50 people crammed inside, and they don't want our missionaries to stop preaching. And they will preach all night long. And then you come and look at the slaves that we have become to the clock. It is very humbling to think what we have done to worship. I suspect that the early church did this because this was life to them. You know what I mean? It just wasn't an event. I suspect that probably in the first century you didn't say, we're going to church. You were the church. Where you went, the church went. And this was a privilege to gather together. What's the difference? This, freedom, materialism, comfort, money. That's the difference. We've got other stuff to do. It's why we want the preacher to wrap it up. They didn't. You know what they had to do? What they were doing. You know what was the highlight of their week? That. Really was. Really was. And no one was sitting around like, man. And if you got hungry, food was in the back. Man, what? That's kind of a nice picture of church. The early church put an emphasis on apostolic teaching. Lastly, this, the early church was marked by miraculous works of power. Let's think about poor Eutychus for a moment. The Greek says he was a young man, though it's not very clear just how young he was. I don't think that necessarily means a boy. There's a different word for boy, but probably a younger man. There are many lamps, verse 8, in the upper room where we were gathered, and his young man, Eutychus, sitting at the window, sank into a deep sleep as Paul talked still longer. He couldn't even use the sleep apnea excuse that some of y'all use. Pastor, when I fall asleep, don't think it's your sermon. I have sleep apnea. I'm like, yeah, but is the sermon helping? I mean, sleep apnea. Being overcome by sleep, he fell down from the third story and was taken up dead. Paul went down, bent over him, taking him in his arms, said, "Do not be alarmed, for his life is in him." And when Paul had gone up, broken bread and eaten, he conversed with him a long while until daybreak, and then he left. Verse 12, and they took the youth away alive. Notice the wording there. It doesn't sound like he just got the air knocked out of him. They took him away alive and were not a little comforted. The early church community was marked by works of power. Now, this too is not prescribed. It is described. But it's described enough that we should ask ourselves why we don't see more works of power. By the way, we do see more than we think we see. Since I've been here 4 years, I've seen works of power. I've seen people in this church healed. And people right here in this room who'll stand up and talk about miracles and what God's done in their life. But the early church was marked by power. They were not marked by boredom. Will Willimon is a guy that I'm an unlikely fan of. I'm a lot more conservative than he is, for one thing, although he's not a real radical leftist or anything, but he's a Methodist bishop, and he wrote a book that I read called Resident Aliens, which is a phenomenal look at the church. I would highly recommend that, Resident Aliens by Stanley Hauerwas and Will Willimon. But Will Willimon was talking about the church, and he said, you know, if you look at the church, there are two things the church in the book of Acts does. One, mission and ministry. They move, they go, they engage. Two, worship and renewal. Missions and worship. And he was making the point that the church today has to have both. Meaning, if all we do is go, go, go and engage and never do this, we're going to burn out and we're going to lose our joy and we're going to miss something. However, if all we do is this without ever engaging, then we're missing the point of this. And Willimon made the point. He said, you know, worship should be a time of rest for a church on mission. So he asked two questions that I thought were significant. He asked this question. He said, is the reason why our worship is so weak because we are not effectively engaging in missions and we don't have anything to recover from? Or is the reason we're not doing missions because our worship is so weak and we're not being recovered enough to do it? In other words, a vibrant church has passionate worship that leads to intentional mission. And I would ask you to ask yourself that on the basis of this passage. When you look at your life, would you say that you have both of those elements? Look, if you're coming to church every Sunday and are not involved at all, I'm not even talking about scheduled mission projects. I'm just talking about your life, being engaged in reaching people. If you're coming, observing, consuming without going and engaging, it really does make you a typical consumer American. American Christianity is mired in consumerism because we don't know how to cut it off. We don't know how to leave Walmart and come to church and not make the church Walmart. So listen to what people say. We pay the preacher to preach sermons we like. We pay the musician to do music that's high quality and we like. This, that, and the other. We outsource Christian activities now to a hired clergy cast, expecting them to perform for us. And that's consumerism. So the consumer Christian is the one who is there, but not out there. The Lone Ranger Christian is the one who is out there and doesn't see the need for this. And what that leads to is a resentment out there of what's happening in here and a denigration of the renewing powers of worship. You see what I mean? So then you're just doing all the time, but you're never worshiping with the gathered community. And so you begin to resent the gathered community of the church. And you say, well, all they do is sit. No, a lot of people have struck a good balance of worship. We need this because of what we did Monday through Saturday. Because we were trying to be salt and trying to be light. And something was expended in that process. And this is renewal for us. So let me just conclude as we begin to approach the Lord's Supper with this statement. We need to be a worshiping, going community. This is why I'm really excited from the perspective of scheduled events. I'm really excited with the response to these mission teams. I think I can say we have people going to Seattle who have not, some have perhaps not been on a mission trip. There's no judgment in that. But I think I'm right in saying that. And that is an awesome thing to see people engage. It's an awesome thing last week to get a text from a church member and say, I'm in, I'm going to Long Island, I'm in, I've thought about it, I'm in. It's an even more awesome thing to hear someone say, man, I went to my neighbor and told him about Jesus. Amen. A going, worshiping church. God will move. God will move in it. But tonight we're going to worship. And we're going to worship by gathering together around the Lord's Supper. Before we do so, let's go to the Lord in prayer and prepare our hearts for the Lord's Supper.